Instead of seeing articles about your efforts to return the agency to its core mission, I'm reading about your interactions with representatives of the industries that you regulate.
As Democrats accuse EPA's Scott Pruitt of close ties to energy lobbyists, Murkowski calls his controversies distracting. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the State Attorney General expands tribal law enforcement authority.
We don't have a trooper or VPSO in every community, but we need law enforcement in every community.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
At a congressional hearing today, senators accused EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt of betraying the public trust with luxury travel and cozying up to lobbyists. All the tough questions came from Democrats, but as Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, Senator Lisa Murkowski did not leap to Pruitt's defense.
Good morning, everyone. Today we're here to review...
Murkowski chairs the Appropriations Subcommittee on Interior and was the only Republican senator at most of the hearing. Democrats, like Senator Pat Leahy of Vermont, accused the administrator of letting his ego run amok. Leahy ridiculed the idea that Pruitt had to travel first class and be guarded at all times to ensure his safety.
Oh, somebody might criticize you. You've got security people that we've never seen before. But you have to fly first class. Oh, come on.
Murkowski says she agrees with many of Pruitt's policy goals, but she says controversies surrounding Pruitt are overshadowing his work.
I'm being asked, really constantly asked, to comment on security, on housing, and on travel. Instead of seeing articles about your efforts to return the agency to its core mission, I'm reading about your interactions with representatives of the industries that you regulate.
She attributed some of that to adversarial politics.
But I do think that there are legitimate questions that need to be answered.
She offered Pruitt essentially an open mic, an opportunity to say whatever he wanted to about the accusations against him. Pruitt did not apologize or accept blame. He attributed much of the criticism to competing political agendas.
There are worldviews that drive the decisions that we make at the agency. And over the last several years, we've seen a competition with respect to how we should approach our business.
Pruitt acknowledged making some decisions he would not make the same way again, but in other cases, he said the agency just didn't have processes in place to prevent abuse from taking place. He cited the $43,000 secure phone booth he had installed in his office as an example of lax internal rules.
There were not proper controls in early to ensure a legal review.
The stated purpose of the hearing was to review the EPA budget for next year. The Trump administration wants to reduce or eliminate programs to improve water infrastructure in Alaska Native communities. It also wants to eliminate a grant program that has helped Fairbanks reduce air pollution by replacing wood stoves with cleaner burning models. Murkowski opposes cuts to both programs. She says the final spending plan for EPA won't much resemble the one the Trump administration proposes. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
State Medicaid money will run out before the end of June. That means many hospitals and other health care providers won't get paid until July. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on how the state is handling the funding shortfall.
The state budget includes $20 million less for Medicaid than state officials say they'll need. That's to cover services provided through June 30th. Hospital advocates criticized the legislature's decision against fully funding what's known as a supplemental. Becky Holtberg is the president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association.
We are very disappointed in the legislature's decision on the Medicaid supplemental. Full funding of the supplemental was obviously tied up in end-of-session budget negotiations, and ultimately, Medicaid was short-funded. That's going to be a significant problem for many of our members.
Normally, the State Department of Health and Social Services pays Medicaid bills within a week. But starting this week, department officials are delaying some payments to large providers that don't rely on Medicaid money to keep the lights on. Shonda O'Brien is the assistant commissioner in charge of the department's finances.
We're trying to do the least amount of harm possible to the smaller providers who are reliant on Medicaid funding.
That means department staff is going through each provider bill and sorting them by category. So community health centers and behavioral health clinics are receiving top priority for payment.
Those entities tend to be in communities where they're maybe the sole provider for that service. And so it's detrimental for them if we don't continue to provide them with the resources they need to keep their doors open.
All of this is happening because Medicaid costs are higher than projected. State officials say this is primarily due to the recession. But Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki notes that the state has built up a backlog of applicants for social services. He says this has been made worse by the increase in the number of people receiving Medicaid. He talked about Medicaid funding at a 1:45 a.m. press availability Sunday after the session ended.
We're going to work with the department to make sure that we can meet those needs, but we also need the department to prioritize services for the most needy as opposed to expanding services.
State officials say the backlog in applications is the result of funding cuts. The House originally supported paying the full amount for Medicaid that Governor Bill Walker's administration requested, but it agreed to reduce the funding in a compromise with the Senate. Anchorage Republican Representative Gabrielle Ledoux says the state should follow through on its commitment to pay Medicaid providers.
The bottom line is we've got Medicaid here. And we've got Medicaid expansion. And when you hire somebody, like a doctor, like a hospital, and you tell them that they're going to get paid, you really ought to pay them in a timely manner, regardless of what you think about, you know, the philosophy of Medicaid.
The state is looking to take steps to reduce Medicaid costs, following up on a bill the legislature passed 2 years ago. That includes hiring contractors to help patients who use healthcare the most. For example, it's cheaper to remind patients about doctor's office appointments than to pay for an emergency room visit after they miss the appointment. Michicki wants the state to lower unnecessary use of healthcare. He also wants the state to be more aggressive in shifting people eligible for the Indian Health Service to IHS billing. This is expected to save the state money over the next year. But Holtberg, the hospital advocate, says efforts to control Medicaid costs are a separate issue from the state following through on its commitment to pay for services.
We support efforts to address Medicaid utilization and to ensure appropriate utilization of healthcare services. Unfortunately, this does not move us any closer to doing that.
Healthcare providers can look forward to a similar problem next year. To pay for the short funding next month, the legislature may be short funding June of 2019. On top of this, the legislature included $10 million less in the new budget than the administration said it would need. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The state is taking steps to expand the criminal justice authority of Alaska Native tribes. Attorney General Jana Lindemuth talked about the initiatives at a tribal court conference in Fairbanks last week. Lindemuth says one allows tribal courts to take over low-level misdemeanor cases from the state.
Keeps that person outside of the state's criminal justice system. And many times that can be really important, especially for a first offender or somebody who's just starting out with dabbling with crime, that we want to avoid them getting into the whole system and starting that lifelong pattern that we see so often. And so I really hope that tribes will look at this closely and that they will consider working with the state on the civil diversion agreement.
A second change allows state-funded village public safety officers to enforce tribal laws.
If you have a VPSO in your community and you want that person to help enforce your tribal code, you need to sit down with your VPSO person and work that out. And it's just a matter of if you can have an agreement in place, then that can go forward. And I really encourage all of you to do that.
A third initiative allows crime evidence collected by tribal officers under state complaint search warrants to be used for prosecution in state court.
We can prosecute that case in state court, even if a trooper never shows up in your community and investigates.
Lindemuth says the three tribal justice initiatives are included in a broader public safety action plan being developed by the state with public input.
We don't have a trooper or VPSO in every community, but we need law enforcement in every community. We need public safety in every community. So how can we do this better? That's what this is all about.
This is pretty amazing stuff, I have to tell you.
Tanana Chiefs Conference Executive Director of Tribal Government and Client Services, Will Mayo, greeted the initiatives with enthusiasm, saying it wasn't too long ago that the state did not even acknowledge the existence of Alaska tribes.
Their belief was that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act terminated any existence of tribes. Tribes did not exist in Alaska. That was the official position. They did not even use the word tribe.
Mayo credited tribes with bringing the state around. The TCC Tribal Court Conference offered training on the new state initiatives. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, from baby food to beer, Alaskans prepare to go to China for economic opportunities.
So they've been working hand in hand actually to get our beer over to China to have there available for people to try as part of these events over there. So obviously we're extremely excited about it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski joined two other Republicans who broke GOP ranks to vote with Democrats today in an effort to protect an Obama-era rule on net neutrality. The Federal Communications Commission repealed the net neutrality rule in September after heavy lobbying by telecommunications companies. The FCC decision would go into effect next month, removing a ban on internet providers blocking or slowing down certain content. But Murkowski and her fellow Republican Senators Susan Collins of Maine and John Kennedy of Louisiana made the vote 52-47 to block the FCC's repeal. In a recorded statement, Murkowski says internet regulations should not shift depending on who runs the FCC.
I voted to pass this resolution today so that we can reset the discussion and really move beyond the politics that are at play here.
Murkowski says she supported the resolution because of rural Alaska's unique reliance on internet access.
In Alaska, at stake are rural health clinics and schools that rely on life-saving telemedicine services and access to educational resources. Telehealth and teleeducation in Alaska is not just important, it's critical.
Murkowski also says she wants to see legislation to prevent internet service providers from blocking certain sites or throttling down internet speeds. Alaska's other senator, Dan Sullivan, says he agrees with that, but Sullivan split with Murkowski and voted against the resolution. In a written statement, Sullivan said he thinks repealing the rule will remove a regulatory burden on Alaska telecommunications companies and encourage infrastructure investment. However, keeping the rule intact is still seen as a long shot. It's unlikely to get support in the Republican-controlled U.S. House or to survive the veto pen of President Donald Trump. This week, more than 40 Alaskans are traveling to China to talk trade. From seafood companies to the Gasline Corporation and even a brewery, the group is hoping to spotlight shared interests between China and Alaska. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
At the 49th State Brew Pub in downtown Anchorage on Tuesday, about 30 people gather in a private room to talk international trade. They're here to discuss how they're going to woo Alaska's largest trading partner into developing deeper ties with the state. Representatives from more than 20 businesses, along with state officials and politicians, will travel to China this upcoming weekend. They'll peddle everything from baby food to seafood to tourism to Chinese consumers. And they'll also bring beer. David McCarthy co-owns Denali Visions 3000. That's the corporation that owns the 49th State Brewing Company. He's hoping to expand the brewery's reach and get Alaska beers into Chinese hands. And this is where Walker's trade delegation comes in.
So when we had a meeting the other day in the governor's office with the entire group, there's seafood companies that are going there presenting seafood. And we said, oh, can we match up our beer? But how do we get it there? And so they've been working hand in hand, actually, to get our beer over to China to have there available for people to try as part of these events over there. So obviously, we're extremely excited about it.
This isn't all just food and travel. Two potentially major infrastructure projects are also hoping to find access to oil and gas markets in China. One is the state's Gasline Development Corporation, and the other is the A2A Railway Development Corporation. They're trying to link Canada and Alaska by rail. Then they could bring Canadian oil sands and potentially minerals from the Yukon to ports in Alaska, then ship them to Asia. Peter Wallace handles public affairs for the Railway Corporation.
From the point of view of Asian business community, this is a great opportunity to achieve access to raw materials out of the north of Canada and Alaska.
The delegation will travel throughout China for the 10-day trip with stops in Shanghai, Beijing, and Chengdu. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, with help from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
A spending bill passed by the legislature revives plans for a road north out of Juneau. The capital budget also provides funds for a hydro project in Cake and a fish hatchery near Petersburg. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
For decades, backers have pushed for construction of a road north out of Juneau. The goal is a closer connection to Haines and Skagway, which have road links to the mainland highway system. But 2 years ago, Governor Bill Walker halted what's called the Juneau Access Project. It was among a group of large projects Walker said Alaska could no longer afford. Juneau Senator Dennis Egan, a Democrat, says that was a mistake.
Everybody you talk to in the rail belt especially says, why can't you drive to the Capitol? Well, unlike Honolulu, we could make a way to drive to Juneau.
That's one reason Egan and other state senators put a little more than $20 million in the capital budget. It's money Walker reallocated to other projects in the same general area, so rather than new spending, it shifted back. Opponents say the project would damage the ocean and the shore where the 50-mile road would be built. They also point out travelers would still have to take a short ferry ride to connect to the mainland road system. There's also a possibility that the governor could veto the reappropriation. The legislature's capital budget also helps fund a hydropower project near Cake, a small southeast city that's dependent on diesel generators. Jody Mitchell is CEO of the Inside Passage Electrical Cooperative, which plans to build at Gunnock Creek.
The project will actually provide estimated 2/3 of the current Cake load. And at times, we'll actually be able to turn the diesels off, which is kind of the gold standard for hydro.
Close to $4 million is appropriated to the project. Mitchell says the nonprofit also hopes to win a $3 million federal grant, which would complete the funding. But if it doesn't, the cooperative could take out a loan. Another project in the capital budget would upgrade the King and Coho Salmon Hatchery at Crystal Lake near Petersburg. It's run by the Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. In an interview earlier this year, production manager Bill Gass said the $1.5 million in the capital budget will replace raceways that have been leaking for several years.
The danger now is that we're afraid that this leak could turn into a catastrophic failure, at which point we could lose the whole thing. So it buys us continued time to operate.
The budget also includes $5 million to help dispose of lead-contaminated soil from an old junkyard in Wrangell. The state plans to store it locally, but leaders want it shipped south. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
This week, we've been bringing you stories from the Battle of Attu and the Greater Aleutian Campaign of World War II. The conflict ended in the 1940s, but its legacy is still very much alive, both for the veterans who served and the Unungan people who were forced to leave during the fighting. To commemorate what happened 75 years ago, KUCB invited people on both sides to sit down and reflect together. Today, we hear from Shayla Shishnikov and Karen Abel. One is the granddaughter of internment survivors, and the other is the granddaughter of a fighter pilot.
My name's Karen Abel, and my grandfather served in the Royal Canadian Air Force in World War II, and he was stationed in Alaska, Kodiak, Umnak, Adak. Who are you?
My name is Shayla Shishnikov. I am a descendant of two evacuees, actually. My grandfather, Larry Shishnikov, he was evacuated when he was 11 years old. And then my great-grandmother, Maria Turnpaugh, was also evacuated and actually gave birth to two of my great-aunts in Burnett Inlet.
And where is that?
That's in Southeast Alaska. They lived in an abandoned cannery. My grandpa said that when they arrived, it was pretty much a shack. It wasn't in living conditions, so the military or the government or whoever it may have been handed them a pile of wood and said, here you go, fix it up.
They did that to the government. The higher government ordered the military to do the same kind of thing to the troops that were coming in. Like when they landed on Umnak, they said, well, here's your tent, dig a hole. The same kind of inhumane
conditions.
Terrible conditions.
Yeah, and I was surprised to hear about that, actually. One of the veterans said that he had served and he'd visited multiple different locations, and that all the while he was wondering where everyone was. He had no idea that that the natives were evacuated.
They didn't.
And then he only found out a few months ago, I think. And that just blew my mind because I had no idea. Coming from Alaska, I guess, and growing up with the stories, I guess I never really thought that much about the perspective of the veterans.
Yeah.
I never even considered that they didn't know what was happening.
And actually, I think what I found now, having talked to a lot of the veterans, and this is several of them, have made the comment that they had no idea. And I think it bothers them, and they don't agree with it. They think it's flat out wrong and inexcusable. Mm-hmm. So I hope it doesn't give them shame because it wasn't their decision to make, because they still should be proud to have served.
Yeah, I'm definitely grateful for the soldiers who, you know, they defended my home. And I know that the Unangak were evacuated for their own safety. It's a shame that no one was prepared and it happened the way it did.
So your family was able to return. How many people, other people, villagers returned with them, do you know?
With numbers, I don't know. I know that 881 Unangak were evacuated from 9 different communities, and that 1 out of every 10 would not return home.
I started researching my grandfather's war history about 5 years ago. He never talked about it, ever. And it wasn't until he passed that we found all his briefcase of documents. And it led me to want to find out what exactly he did. So I started learning a lot about relocation camps. So I guess you could call them relocation camps. And I found it difficult to celebrate what my grandfather and the other military did, knowing that there were so many people of our own people who suffered because of it. how do I still have honor for those who served but not disregard those who got relocated and had their homes taken away?
It's definitely an interesting balance. I guess I could say I'm extremely proud of my grandparents for, you know, coming through that. I like to say that they persevered in a world that didn't favor them. My grandfather really made something of himself. He was a very successful fisherman, and today the deadliest catch boat, the Wizard, actually catches his quota for him. He also owned the Elba Room, which was a very popular bar here in Unalaska. My great-grandmother had 14 children, so we've got a big family.
Wow.
And she was a very talented artist, so I'm very proud of them, and I'm proud of who it's shaped us all to be, I guess. It's even a part of me. Even though I didn't experience it, it's sort of incorporated itself into my personal history. So there is that balance of we don't celebrate it, per se, the evacuation that is, but I guess we just honor everyone who was involved, the military and the locals who had to leave their homes.
Do you hold resentment towards what happened?
I don't hold resentment against the military. I'm upset with the way it happened because I know it hurt a lot of people and a lot of people were lost. But I'm not upset with the soldiers who were here and who fought. I guess I'm upset with those who made the decision, those who were there with the Yunangak in the internment camps, those who told them not to speak their language, those in particular people who look down on the natives. I guess I could say that I do resent them. But against the military and the United States as a whole, I can never say that.
Hmm.
No.
Yeah. War is not pretty.
No.
For everyone.
Every side.
Every side.
That remembrance was produced by KUCB's Laura Craigle and Zoe Sobel. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Zoe Sobel and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.